Not long before she died, my mother gave me quite a turn. I was visiting her in a nursing home called Cromwell's, in the same Yorkshire village where she'd lived for 40 years. For most of my childhood, Cromwell's had been the Manor House Hotel, a business that failed to prosper, no matter how often it changed hands. She hated the grey stone gauntness of the building, and when it became a nursing home, said she'd rather take an overdose than end up there. In the event, when she became too ill to manage at home, it seemed the only sensible option. She resented the indignity, but accepted the logic. Friends and neighbours could drop by. My sister lived just across the road. The rooms in Cromwell's are named after English poets, and when my mother was admitted, they put her in Larkin. Not a good omen. The room was far from unpleasant, but this was a place for the elderly, and I wondered what Larkin, the laureate of death, would have made of being commemorated in this way. In time, my mother switched rooms. The staff could see she wasn't thriving and moved her to Byron, near the main entrance, where there was always someone passing by. She wasn't going to recover. A fungal infection, Aspergillus, had taken over her lungs, but it was thought her spirits might improve in a busier part of the home, Larkin being a gloomy backwater. The move paid off. A month of Byron, and she was much brighter. The last time I'd visited, on a day trip from London, she'd talked so long and hard that I left feeling exhausted, as though it was me who needed nursing, while she burned invincibly on. This time, I'd been in Hull for a conference, as it happened, on Larkin's poetry, an excuse to see my mother on the way home. Hull to Skipton is no small hop, but at least they're up the same end of the country. Around 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, sweaty from two trains and a minicab, I walked in on her without knocking, then halted and began to retreat. I'd got the wrong room, I thought. But Byron was the name on the door. Well then, they'd put the wrong woman in it. The tiny figure with thin white hair under the sheets couldn't be my mother. But it was. She was. I recognised the mohair cardigan on the bedside chair and the radio she'd brought over from the house. "Mum," I said several times, until the old lady stirred from fetal sleep and greeted me. I pulled the curtains wide and helped her sit upright. We talked on long past lunch. Later, my sister Jill came over. And by the time I left, my mum was indisputably my mum again. But I felt shocked at having failed to recognise her. She was old and frail that day, not herself, and about to become so forever. And yet my error seemed symptomatic. It was as though I didn't really know her, as though she'd always been someone else. That comes from the beginning of this book. And it's a book written, I suppose, out of the sense that you can be very close to somebody and think you know them. And I certainly felt very close to my mother, closer, I think, than I did to my father. But towards the end of the life, and more especially after her death, I began to realise there were lots of things about her I didn't know. And that seems to be a familiar experience. People will tell you, you know, too late, you realise that your parents actually had interesting lives. You know, that all that boring old stuff about, you know, fighting in the war and or whatever it is, actually it's far more interesting than your life has ever been, but you realise too late. Anyway, belatedly I became interested in my mother, and belatedly I realised I hadn't known her as well as I thought. And that little incident was one example, but of a symbolic kind, if you like, but other things happened too. One of them was that after her death, I discovered a letter written to my mother from somebody who's actually here in the audience tonight, though I can't see where, a relation of mine, Margaret, who was writing to my mother, I didn't know her, saying she wanted to make inquiries about her grandmother, Madge, who was my mother's sister. The letter said, well, I'd never heard of Madge. I didn't know. I knew my mother had one or two sisters and brothers, and I reckoned there were about six of them, and they often passed through Yorkshire on their way to on holiday or on business or whatever. But Madge, no, that didn't know anything about any Madge. And at the funeral, Auntie Beattie, who was who wasn't an auntie at all, who was a woman who had been a close friend of my mother, but a rather closer friend of my father, an undefined relationship that sort of hung over my childhood. She came to the funeral and she said, you know, nobody here on your mother's side. And I said, well, you know, she was from Ireland, and there was nobody left in her generation, that, you know, she was the last to die. And she said, Beattie, you know, well, yes, there were seven or eight of them, maybe more than that, she said. And I realized I didn't know how many brothers and sisters my mother had. And it seemed quite a thing not to know about your own mother. A few months later, we took a family holiday in Killorglin in County Kerry, the town where my mother had grown up. It had taken me a long time to remember that it was Killorglin. My mother somehow always managed to not talk about where she grew up or her childhood very much. And I noticed my father also had this capacity never to really remember where she came from. But anyway, somehow or other we got to this place. I knew there were cousins of mine still living in the town. And I knew that, more importantly, the last survivor of that generation was there, the widow of one of my mother's brother, Joe. She was called Auntie Bridie, and I saw her and talked to her about the family and said, you know, I never knew about how many brothers and sisters were and all the siblings, because we never had holidays in Ireland, and my mother never talked about her childhood. And we didn't have holidays in Ireland, we had one. Whereas my father's family, which was from Lancashire, we saw a massive amount of. All we ever saw of Ireland was the visitors passing through Yorkshire. And she said, well, you know, your grandfather wrote a list of the children. I've got it somewhere. I will give it you. So she did, and handed it over to me, and there were 20. And my mother, who I thought was maybe the sixth of seven or the fifth of sixth or whatever it was, who I then looked in my diary and see I somehow got a figure of 10 somewhere. Turned out she was the 19th of 20. And coming from the family I did, growing up, two doctors as parents, small nuclear family, 1950s, 60s, you know, 2.2 children and the dog, this seemed rather amazing. And there was this list. I'll just read a little bit. All these names and numbers, a near alphabet, an A to Z, or at any rate an A to T, 20 children in 24 years. By any standards, that was going it some. Nearly a quarter of a century of pregnancies and births. How could my mother have called her mother, as she did, a lady of leisure? Some of the gaps between children were less than a year, scarcely long enough for a woman to have recovered from the last labour before embarking on the next. The second and third children, John and Chris, came barely 10 months apart. Was Margaret O'Shea one of those women whose children just popped out? In legends and dirty jokes, such women as she expire worn out before they're 40, but she'd lived to be 72. She'd had two generations worth of children, almost. A Victorian Edwardian period, followed by an Edwardian Georgian. How differently those two generations fared, though. Of those in the first half, 6 died as infants, 2 more before they were 30. Only Chris and Madge lived on. 1901 to 1904 was the worst patch. 4 children dead, 1 for every year. Miniature coffins became the family furniture. My grandparents, since I never knew them, it still seemed odd to say it. My grandparents must have thought of stopping then. 10 births in 10 years, but only 4 survivors. Luckily, lucky for my mother, lucky for me, they persevered. And how? 10 more children, 9 of whom lived on to adulthood, 8 to a good age. Only that stillborn son to mar the years 1906 to 18. No more children after that. They'd surely have stopped anyway. Margaret was 44, and in the modest accommodation they had, must have felt like old Mother Hubbard. I'd been told that the children slept on opposite sides of Langford Street. The boys at the family pub, the girls above the shop. A double dormitory arrangement. There wasn't the room for them in the one shoe. So suddenly this other world of my mother's childhood had opened up for me a little. And I felt not anger, not resentment at my mother for keeping this to herself or repressing the memory of it or whatever it was. But I just felt sad that we hadn't talked about this, and I felt slightly bewildered genealogically that this had all been shut off from this. And other cousins of mine had fully participated in, you know, life back in Coolorglin, whereas I'd only had my father's side of things. And so my mother, who I suppose I'd always had this urge to write about, but had never imagined I could. I'd written about a book about my father, and it seemed to me only fair in a way that I should write one about my mother too. It's fair, you know, you'd be like, you have two parents, and you're doing the one. What does that mean if you don't do the other, that you don't love them as much? If guilt were the motive, maybe I would have found a way to write about my mother just out of, yeah, guilt and justice. But how was I going to do it? I didn't know enough about her. And then I remembered that my father had kept a lot of letters, rather in the way that a parent shows a teenage child something and says, you know, one day that you might value that, that'll come in useful. I could remember my father pointing out this huge stack of envelopes and saying, you know, there's some more letters in there that you might find interesting one day, son. And I remember thinking, well, you know, unlikely. but never mind, I humoured him, I didn't comment, and then suddenly they began to accrue in value after his death. Anything belonging to him began to seem precious, and after my mother's death, they seemed the most precious thing I had, although I hadn't a clue what was in them. And it took me about 6 months to nerve myself to read them. I'll just read you one or two letters from this stash I stumbled on. As I describe it in the book, I'd stumbled into the archive of my parents' courtship. Arthur to Agnes, 13th of April, 1944. Your last letter to me was delayed because the M looked like an H and was delivered to a Harrison in another section. You'll have to be less of a medical professional in your writing in future. Any mail delays are frustrating. But one day we'll be able to whisper things to one another for the rest of our lives. And then she writes to him on the 6th of June, 1944, Normandy Landings Day. Terrific news, isn't it? First Rome, then this. Heard hundreds of planes going over about 5 a.m., but never thought of the Second Front. It does seem strange just sitting here as usual, with all this excitement going on. Makes me wish I were doing something. so I wonder how you feel. But I'm glad you are where you are. Well, where he was on a camp bed in the Azores, about as far from as it's possible to be from the action. And mostly he was quite glad to be there doing next to nothing. But round about this time he found it very frustrating. There was adventure and excitement happening in France and he wanted to be there. But his was a war spent firstly in Iceland as an RAF doctor and then in the Azores. So hardly in the thick of it. My mother, on the other hand, had come over from Ireland as a doctor, newly qualified, and had had a succession of jobs in British hospitals, Manchester, Birmingham, up and down the country, all over the place. And she did not have the time to write the letters that he had. Her letters tend to be shorter than his, because she's always having to break off, saying, "Oh, we're just being called baby problem down in maternity ward," or whatever it is. She has to break off for some crisis, whereas he has endless time on his hands, on his camp bed. So it's a very different kind of correspondence. But there they were. I mean, I had my parents and their voices at a time of their life, which normally, I suppose, you don't, as a child, get access to, because as a child, that's the bit before you were a child, that's the bit before you, that you didn't exist. Indeed, of course, my parents at that time didn't know they were going to be together. They didn't know they were going to be parents at all. I knew the ending of this story, but one of the strange things about reading through the letters was finding, well, yeah, because these two people don't know what's going to happen. They don't know what the ending is, and I did. And that was a strange feeling. And so was the feeling of being older than them. I mean, I had them in their early mid-20s. They were younger than me. I was the parent, somehow. I was the protective older one, worrying about these problems they were having. Whereas when I'd written a book about my father, I was a child screaming with pain at having lost a parent. So it was an extraordinary experience to read these letters. Of course, I'm a guilty kind of person. I felt guilty reading them. I felt maybe I shouldn't. My father had kept them. He said, "This is for you." And yet, of course, these were private letters, and I did feel some inhibitions. The ones that I just quoted there, you may have noticed, he refers to her as Agnes. He calls her Dear Agnes. Well, that's actually me. I mean, because it's early on in the book, and I'm cheating slightly, because the very first letter he writes to her, he doesn't call her Agnes, which is her real name. He begins it, "Dear Jenny." And I knew that my mother, who was known as Kim to her husband and to her friends and to those patients of hers who knew her well enough to use her first name, she was Kim. I knew she'd been Agnes, but what I hadn't realized was quite how early on in the relationship they decided to change her name. This was my father's idea, I think, partly. He didn't like Agnes, but luckily for him, she didn't like it either. And so there they are. They only met a few months before, and they're busily christening her. And they talk about it as the christening. You know, "We forgot to do the christening, didn't we? Oh, damn." So, I mean, and he tries Jenny, calls her Jenny for a bit. I don't know why Jenny. But she doesn't really respond to Jenny. She doesn't ever sign off her letters Jenny. So they resume. He tries others on her. He says, "Have you thought about it?" He says, "Don't like sherry." Not the drink. He liked the drink probably. But, you know. "Don't like sherry. Have you some suggestions? Something short and catchy, but not too boyish like Bobby, which doesn't fit you. What about Billy? Quite sweet. Anyway, your turn now." I'm thinking, Bobby, Billy. what is this? And then I realised that his previous girlfriend that he'd been very close to down in Plymouth was called Terry. Later, we called our family Labrador Terry. But one day, and she offered him Una. Una, the Irish for Agnes. She said, Una, how about that? Silence. No response from him. So he throws out Kim, and she thinks probably Kim sounds chic and modern and okay. And so Kim it was, and became. Of course, to me, to find this surrender of her so early on in their relationship was unnerving. I mean, I knew my mother, of course, well enough to see other surrenders that she'd made, but I thought if she'd hung on there, stuck up. Okay, she didn't like Agnes, but if she'd hung on to it a bit more, maybe she could have stuck up for herself in other ways too. But as it was, she made these surrenders. One was about the name. One was perhaps about underplaying her Irishness. She'd lost her accent a bit and it wasn't something she dwelt on. And the fact I could never remember where she came from, well, that was deliberate. But the big thing, and this suddenly started to come through about halfway through this stash of letters, was religion. Now, not that she was a worshipper, not that my father was, but religion turned out to be a huge issue between them. I hadn't known this. I had grown up in this non-church-going household. In fact, aged about 8 or 9, I found that a couple of my friends, I grew up in a small village, were going to the church on Sunday. They joined the village choir, and this was the only way to get to see friends at the weekend. So I asked. I was the first child in the history of civilization to ask if he could go to church, please. And my parents said no. You know, it will ruin Sunday. It's a very bad idea. My father particularly said that. My mother was quieter, and I didn't know quite what she felt. And what I hadn't realized was that, you know, there had been this battleground years before between them. And this was that she was, of course, as would be clear if you said you came from Ireland and you were the 19th of 20, she was Catholic. And he was, well, what was he? He wasn't really Protestant in the sense of being a believer or a church attender. He would have thought of himself as a rationalist, a modernist, secular, atheist. But primarily he was anti-Catholic. And he was anti-Catholic because his father was anti-Catholic. And his father was anti-Catholic because he was born in Manchester and he was a businessman. He inherited that sort of nonconformist kind of hatred of Catholics, and especially Irish Catholics. And I mean, I didn't realize this was going on in the middle of the last century with such ferocity. It was a revelation to me that two people who never talked about religion when I was a child could spend most of this correspondence banging on, well, not most, but a large part, having this terrific argument. And the argument was that they wanted to be together, they loved each other, they wanted a life, but they couldn't marry. They couldn't marry because he was not going to marry her in a Catholic church, and she wasn't going to marry him in a registry office. Couldn't be done. And his letters are hilarious, I think, because he tries to persuade her of the illogic of being a Catholic in the modern world, how it's, you know, a barbaric kind of religion, and he genuinely thinks he can reason her out of it. If you read, it goes on long enough, she'll suddenly one day say, yeah, oh yeah, I see it now, of course, Catholicism is barbaric, superstitious religion, I give it up, I surrender. And she was not particularly church-going. I mean, she was very glad, not, it turns out in these letters, she was working somewhere and there wasn't a Catholic church nearby, so she didn't have to go. But it was bound up with her identity. She said to him, one of these letters, look, you asking me to give up being Catholic is like me asking you never to see your family again. And that kind of gave it to me. That's what it meant to her. It was bound up with her sense of the early self she'd been. But of course she was surrendering this early self to him. And in the end, they did marry without going into the reasons that enabled them to solve this problem. That's going to be the little dangler, the suspense bit, that as I leave with you. They did marry and solved that problem. I want to leave time for a little conversation and questions, so I'm going to read from the end of the book. Carol's talked about the poetry that I write, and I think of this bit as the where I let myself, it's not poetry, but I let myself go a bit. because primarily this was a book of research. I mean, this is not recalling my childhood, this is before my time, and a lot of it involved, of course, transcribing these letters and editing them and finding the story that was in them, but also filling in the gaps, because there are lots of gaps in the letters. And one of the nice things about the gaps is that I realised whenever correspondence stopped, that meant my parents were together. I couldn't work it out at first. No letters for a few weeks, and then realised he was at home on leave or something, and they'd been together. And anyway, I'm going to just read from the end of this book. One day I'll get the call, is this last section. One day I'll get the call. It'll be Jill, my sister, at 9 in the morning. She's just been phoned by Janice at Cromwell's, the nursing home. My mother's suddenly worse, is very blue, in fact, a matter of blood supply, not mood. And she, Jill, thinks I should come today. I'm sceptical. My mother's always had cold toes and fingers. Her being blue doesn't sound like the end to me. Distrustful, I'll call Janice, wanting it straight from her. It's difficult to say, she'll say. My mother's not in distress yet. She'd give her diamorphine if she were, but that would retard her breathing, which is already slower than it was. It's difficult to say, but if I can come, I better have. Today, if possible. Quickly. Right away. I'll put the phone down in the study, trembling. For months, I'll have seen this coming, but now it has come, unseen. I'll look out beyond the roses framing the glass door, past the summer flowers on either side of the basement steps, to the bland suburban scene on the lawn beyond, hammock, folding chairs, badminton net, and it won't seem possible anyone could die on a day like this. Death in all the books, being a winter thing, death in my own small experience, my father, 5 years ago, meaning the short light of December and flurries of snow. I'll tell myself this, intending to hang on a couple of hours, no panic. There's work I need to do, things I'm meant to think about. But unable to work or think, I'll have a bag packed in 15 minutes and be gone. I'll be in good time at King's Cross, early enough to walk the platform to the front of the train, where there's an all but empty carriage and a table to myself. I'll spread my books and papers out, but the 2 hours 40 minutes to Leeds will be spent looking out the window. Nothing written, nothing read. Out the window and into the past. I've done this journey so often lately, shuttling between my home and my mother's home, that the train is like a home too. I'll work out that at an average of a trip a month, though sometimes it's been once a week and this is only counting my trips, not the holidays in Yorkshire en famille, I must have spent around £4,000 on these journeys in the past few years. Good son behaviour. But bad son to calculate the cost. The devil take me. But it's probably my mother I get it from. Didn't she hit the roof if ever I called her before 6, when the cheap rate begins? Or if I came from London at times, ineligible for a super saver? The Scripton train is scheduled to depart from Leeds 1 minute after the London train arrives. An unguaranteed connection, even if you sprint. But today, we're coming early. I'll make it easily with 3 minutes to spare. It all goes so smoothly that a calm will descend, as if she cannot die today, or will wait till we are with her, son and daughter. A replay of my father's death, in a home rather than at home, but otherwise straight from a Victorian novel, textbook perfect, the family gathered round the bed. This sense of calm will last all the way to Shipley. where the train sits for 20 minutes before a platform loudspeaker apologises for the delay due to an unidentified object being thrown onto the line at Keighley. I'll sit there at the little station as the minutes pass and more people sigh, tut, collect their things, get off. And now at last I'll get off the train and go in search of a taxi. Wandering the streets, I'll imagine my mother reproaching me when I reach her. A taxi? All the way from Shipley? How much did that set you back? What was the rush? You knew I'd be here. Before I find a taxi, shouldn't I ring from a call box and see how she is? If she's better, or dead already, a slow journey by coach won't matter. And yet it does matter. I start to panic. I want to get there fast. There'll be four cabs parked in a row in the main square, all very local looking. I'll stick my head in the window of the front one and the driver will pat the seat and say, "Please get in, sir." When I try to ask him first, can he take me to the other side of Skipton, 20 miles off at least, well beyond his usual circuit, he'll simply pat the seat again. I get in beside him, my two bags dumped behind us. He'll be big, friendly, Asian, his skin slightly pockmarked. "So Skipton then," he'll say, pointing out that the cab is metered and also, paradoxically, that he needs my money now. I'll reassure him, I have the money, it's okay. And we'll set off slowly. In the heavy traffic, it's hard for him to make headway, but even when we have a clear stretch, he'll drive at 30, and I begin to wonder if he's got the point, though I say it twice more, that I'm in a rush because my mother's very ill. Most of the time, he'll be jabbering into his mouthpiece at the end of its flex. He says something, then clicks a button, producing a hiss from the mouthpiece, and a voice through it also jabbering. "My friend," he'll explain, a big grin across him. And he adds that he is himself from Keighley, not Shipley, so he knows the way to Skipton. It's okay. And I'll wonder if it is okay, if a man on the way to his mother's death doesn't deserve better than this. Someone who'll be serious and dignified, or at least get me there in time. "Have I ever been to Pakistan?" he'll ask. "Well, I've been to India, but no. His family's from Kashmir. When he went back to visit last year, it was jabber jabber all the time. With Asians, wherever they are, it's always jabber jabber," he says. "The English are so quiet," he finds. He'll ask where I live, and then how I like it in London, and don't I miss Yorkshire, which I do. "My mother and sister are still here," I'll say. Silent brackets. My mother, only just. "I often come to visit, but my children are London children, and it's where I've lived for over 20 years. "And his home?" "His home is Keighley," he'll say. "He doesn't like London, it's a muckhole. He visited once, never again." "So is the attraction here, the countryside?" I'll ask, nodding at a hay meadow or at some cow-packed heavy acre by the river. "No, he prefers the towns. They all do, his friends, his family." "But in Pakistan there must be many people who live off the land." "Yes," he'll say, "it's town we like," not understanding what I'm getting at or politely contradicting me. "You work the land only if there's nothing else. Only white middle-class Europeans are romantic about fields." It'll be drizzling steadily now since Swithin's day two, which means rain for 40 days and nights. But he'll be making progress nonetheless, reaching 50 on the Skipton bypass, though the steering wheel judders if he goes any faster. Finally, in 10 minutes, we're there, outside Cromwell's. He'll wait while I search my pockets for the fare. By now, he has taken in the kind of place this is and can't help but see, as I do, an ancient face peering forlornly through the window. When he takes my money, not meeting my eyes, I'll sense he seriously disapproves of me, putting my mother, as no Muslim would, in a home. I feel judged by him as he drives off. There's him, a local man with family values, and here's me, an alien from the wilds of London, with no sense of kinship or blood. Janice will be waiting to let me in. Not the Janice I spoke to earlier, but the smaller, blonder deputy who shares her name. I'll walk to the Byron room. My mother will be there still. Even if she were dead, she'd be there, but she's alive, unconscious, her head propped on the pillow, not struggling to draw in air, not coughing either as she has these past few months, but breathing more easily. Jill will be sitting beside her. We'll have been there all day and we'll kiss each other on the cheek, perfunctorily, neither of us willing to be distracted. She'll say that Mum talked a little round lunchtime, a yes or no of acknowledgement, nothing more, but has uttered nothing since. And I'll sit on the edge of the bed and hold my mother's hands. According to Janice, she will probably, possibly die tonight, but her breathing's easy, so it may take longer. At this, reassured, Jill will leave to cross the road to her house. Her kids are back from school and there's tea to make. I'll settle in for a long vigil. But 5 minutes after Jill leaves, my mother's eyes will suddenly widen. She'll stare me in the face. My heart will lift and I'll start to chatter very quickly, very quietly, little nothings, comfortings, communication lines to reel her back in. Mum, I'm here. I know you're not well today, you've had a bad day, but we're all looking after you. I'm here now. Jill's been here. Janice is here too. I'm here, see. Can you hear me? I'm here. I'll say all this, but she'll just stare at me and then her brow will wrinkle slightly. The trace of a frown, as if she's half registered what I said, but doesn't agree or doesn't know what to make of it. And then she'll express a deeper puzzlement at something unprecedented happening, at which her face will cloud and her mouth clamp, and a little trickle of something will come from the corner of her lips, and then she'll open her mouth wider, awkwardly, as if to say something huge and definitive, to cough it out at last, to assert herself and make it plain. And the effort of this cough or assertion is so hard that her eyes will close, scrunch up, and water with the effort. And the silent cough will pass through her, and then again pass through her, and then a third time. And when her mouth opens and closes the third time, there'll be no breath anymore, only a tear in the corner of one eye. And the way both eyes widen and stare at the start of this will remind me exactly of my father, the last moment of his looking through me, and the whole of life passing before his eyes. I look at the clock, 6:05 p.m. I got here just 40 minutes ago. I'll be hyper and trembly, and I'll put my face to hers like a mirror wanting to mist up. And because I've convinced myself she may be breathing still, or just anyway, I let go of her hand and call Jill from the bedside phone and tell her to come now, fast, now. And it isn't imagination, because I'll see the pulse in my mother's neck move and lower in the neck another pulse. And then the doorbell will ring at the front of the house, and then, no one answering, ring again, and I'll rush to let Jill in and race back, and we'll sit on either side of the bed, leaning over the body we both came from, scanning it for life. At some point, Jill will reach to feel if there's a pulse, but it'll be my wrist that she holds instead, which we don't notice for a moment, and are fooled by life, hope, until we laugh, or is it cry at the absurdity, because we know there can be no doubt now. But we'll not fetch anyone else yet. We want this, her, for ourselves. It will be peaceful sitting there. No need to fear the worst will happen. Now it has happened. And for the best. After 5 minutes or so, I'll go into the corridor and call for Janice, any Janice, and one of them will come in a bit harassed, a bit taken aback and slightly nervous, as if we might feel shocked or cheated by the suddenness. She'll feel the nothing pulse and then ask us to give her 10 minutes alone to tidy the poor darling up, which reluctantly we do. When we come back, our mum will be lying flat, no props anymore, and there'll be a yellow flower between her hands, its petal resting on her chin. I'll hate that flower, on principle, out of love and loyalty, knowing my mother would have hated it too. I'll want to touch her in sympathy for having to hold it, and for all she had to suffer before. But I'll feel inhibited from touching her, as I didn't with my father when he died. It feels invasive and impropriety. Impassive, high cheekbone, and with her hair drawn back, my mother will look beautiful. All has been shed now, warmth, flesh, stubbornness, life. She'll look like the lamb inside the sheared sheep, almost a child, Agnes. And the day of her funeral will be summery but chaste, dark cloud respectfully covering the blue. Ragged robin and cow parsley will bloom in the untended garden, pink fuchsia by her front door. An old friend or two will cry off, but the church will be full. And after that, and after the creme, 30 or so guests will come back to my parents' house, as they've often done, but never, as today, without the hosts. Outside, at the edge of the lawn, half a dozen children, sharing one club, will chip and drive golf balls down the meadow until the last of the balls is lost. And I'll worry, was it wrong for an Irish Catholic to die in a place called Cromwell's? And I'll wonder if the window of her room when she died was open. In legends, the soul departs through the gateway of the teeth, and then if there's a window open out the house, otherwise the soul remains in purgatory. Did a shadow pass over? Was there an extra white cabbage butterfly dancing outside? And afterwards, in the empty house, my sister, pissed, will say, of course I know, don't I, that she, Mum, loved her, Gillian, more than she loved me. And next morning, 5 crows and 4 magpies will commandeer the lawn, moving in on the dead, swaggering about as if they owned the place. And the morning after that, my last in Yorkshire, there'll be a blue skimmed sky and mist in the valley bottom by the canal. And at night, I'll lie back on the grass and look upwards at the August sky, at shooting stars, the ash fall of galaxies, so big tonight, not the usual little angled volleys, but flaring well drops, vertical plummetings with a stitch of silver left behind, heart-stopping to watch, such fire and elation. And I'll remember that when my mother almost died back in February, the Halley-Bopp comet looked on from one corner of the sky. Its flare was white and in slow-mo, like the fungus in her chest. Whereas this August light show is celebratory, long lives passing before our eyes in an instant, lit snail trails speeded up a million times. A nice way to think about the dead, that these could be their frolicking souls, each zip trace a happy goodbye to us, as if to say, we're all right, let us go now, don't grieve. And months later, we'll spread our ashes among the roses where my father's were spread, and we'll go back to Killorglin and climb Corunta Hill, Ireland's highest mountain, losing ourselves on its summit and exhausting ourselves from damp and panic till we find a way down. And all these things will happen ahead. But part of me won't ever catch up. We'll still be in the car, travelling towards them, alongside the driver whose parents, like my mother, came here from another country and learned to call it home. The diaspora, the multitudes seeking an elsewhere, the lives they left behind. These hills have seen it all before. The streams trickling down their face suggest they're saddened by it, as I've been, thinking of what my mother gave up. It is not a tragedy. I see that now. Not been for this driver and his parents, it wasn't for her. Haven't I too made a life elsewhere? What's wrong with that? To give up what you've known is nothing in exchange for love and freedom and work. Let me grieve for my mother, but let me not pity her. What did she say when I last saw her? It's been a good life. I'll begin to feel better remembering that. I'll lean back in the seat of the cab as we inch towards Cromwell's through the summer light. Go on, the driver will grin. Make yourself comfortable. Then the car will pick up speed and long shadows will fly past.
My father was 94 when he died 2 years ago. And like your parents, his life seemed to span almost two two lives. And I was just wondering whether, as a writer of those stories, whether you were pleased to have those secrets that were there but still retained their privacy, or whether you ultimately would like not to have known. Did you have too much, or did you not have enough?
You can never have enough. I don't feel I have too much. There are things that I accept that I will never know and have no right to know. The nature of my father's relationship with Auntie Beattie, I'll never know what that is. And you know, that was one of the lessons I learned writing that book, in a way, is that it's something she wrote to me. You know, I'm looking for a bit of the jigsaw. I'm trying to make sense of my parents' life and my life, the lives of their generation, my generation, and families, and so on. But she said, you know, yeah, it's a bit of jigsaw for you, but that's my piece of jigsaw, that's mine, and it's not yours, and that's true. So you have to accept the things you won't ever know. There are things that you're not told that you'd like to know, but there are things you'll never know, and you accept that.
Well, do you think that there were areas of not knowing that your parents didn't tell you about because they had a sense of shame that almost turns into what our generation celebrates about our parents' lives retrospectively?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, my father, I'm not sure that any of this applies to him, but my mother had, it seems absurd, I think, a sense of shame about the background, which was not impoverished by any means. I mean, their father was, you know, did very well as a wool merchant. The children had a good education, the girls especially, you know, had a good education at a time you wouldn't necessarily expect girls to have a good education. What was there to be ashamed of? But when she came to England and met anti-Catholic prejudice and anti-Irish prejudice, perhaps the anti-Irish prejudice strong at that time, the war, Ireland being neutral, she had a sense of shame, and I think, I'm not sure she ever deliberately lied to me about her childhood, you know, but I don't know how you can forget that you have all those brothers and sisters in the 1920. I mean, it was certainly something that would be lodged in my consciousness, but she'd somehow either repressed that or, there was too much shame, and as you say, it's precisely the thing that I found wonderful and exotic and great. I mean, and of course, we all want to be Irish now. I mean, what could be better than being Irish? But at that time, before Angela's Ashes, it wasn't during the war, maybe it wasn't. And she was, you know, there were people who, and this is true of not just for the Irish, but other refugees. Like, I mean, you dumped that original identity. Mm. You were assimilated. You covered it up, played it down.
I was thinking, as you were just speaking about the last lines of King Lear, when Edgar says that we who are young will never know so much or live so long, are we going to have similar stories of repression and shame that are going to turn into the next generation's stories, if you will?
Well,
this
maybe.
Is revelation time now.
Where
we turn from biography to confession.
I'm not going to tell you any of those stories, but we like to think we're more open, don't we? We like to think ours is, you know, the generation that grew up and blew away all the cobwebs and opened the cupboards with the skeletons in and blew it all away. And, you know, if you're gay or if you're Irish or you had an abortion or whatever it is, that, you know, that's, we accept that, and the stigma and the shame are not as great anymore. So, nonetheless, there will probably be things that we've underplayed or misrepresented to our children that they'll find interesting and will be accused of being secretive. I don't know.
I'm just thinking too, thinking back immediately of that wonderful essay you wrote called Bloody Students, about what it was like being an undergraduate at Nottingham and returning to Nottingham about 20 years later and thinking about what it was like. So maybe there's some place for your children to start with. With your mother, did she get her name back post-mortem, or is this testament part of renaming her? I think lots of women in this room are kind of feeling very protective of your mother and her name, thinking,
yeah. You know, my sort of slightly weird theory is that, of course, you know, St. Agnes means St. Agnes, and she's always pictured carrying a lamb, and the family business was wool, and, you know, she wanted to get away from all that. So she didn't like Agnes. She got her name back in the sense that every time I go to Ireland, you know, I meet my cousin there and they talk about Auntie Agnes. She was never kin to them. They didn't know it. She never acquired this other name.
Would you like to join in this conversation?
It's rather difficult to see.
That's all right. They'll throw them. They'll throw them.
They just have to shout without sticking their hand up.
Yes.
She went on her own, apart from this one family holiday that we had when I was about five. She didn't want us to go with her. That was her world, and she wanted to keep it to herself, and maybe this slight unnecessary sense of shame attached to it, I don't know. But wasn't up for discussion.
Do you know the story of how she became a doctor? Because that's kind of an extraordinary thing for a young woman to train. She must have trained, what, in the late 30s?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one story was that she had a very good friend locally called Mary Galvin who said, you know, let's train as nurses. Well, let's train as chemists. And my mother said, no, let's train as doctors. That might be one of those apocryphal ones. But what's clear is she and Mary Galvin did train as doctors at UCD in Dublin, University College, the National University. And I looked at I managed to get hold of a list of those graduating in medicine the same year as my mother, 1942, and a quarter of the graduates were women. So, rather more than we might assume. And, you know, as I said earlier, she and her sisters all have good convent education. They trained as teachers or whatever. Grandfather O'Shea clearly believed in girls being educated as well as boys. I mean, whereas Grandpa Morrison took a rather different line.
Yorkshireman!
One of the things that comes out in the letters is my father teases my mother about how she's going to have to stop working when he comes back from the war. Mm-hmm. Her career is leaping ahead, you know, she's being a surgeon, she's doing all sorts of things that, as he sees it, you know, if the men hadn't gone off to fight the war, a young Irish woman like her would never have these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And he's jealous, he's very jealous, and his camp bed in his oars as she's stitching people up. But, you know, it's clear, he says, you know, when I'm home, you'll have to start the housework and give up. And there's a teasing element to it, which because I think he knew that she would never, ever not work. She loved her work too much. But, of course, it was true that women were under that pressure in 1945, 1946. And if you were a teacher and you were married, you didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure you were allowed to work, whether you had children or not.
And all that's rather. What happened next? Did she give up work, or did she continue to practice?
No. The first medical practice they had, she made one surrender, I think. I think she'd have been happier working all her life in hospitals, but she agreed to go into practice with my father's GP in a small town on the Lancashire Yorkshire border. And they rolled up and bought a house, and in those days, pre NHS, many GPs had their surgeries in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the surgery was, in fact, down the side of the house, kind of next to the kitchen. So you can imagine my mother being in the kitchen hearing the surgery on the other side of the wall. She would never have been able to put up with that. So very quickly these ideas were abandoned, and she took on extra work outside the practice in the local maternity hospital. She worked until she retired, and I think she would have happily gone on longer, and that was the only mistake, retiring when my father did. She should have gone another 10 years. And she loved it. I'm tempted to say no. put it all in. I think one person who read this book early on, in draft form, said that I was being a little too inhibited about my parents' sex lives, and I should talk about that. But I mean, that was the one place I wasn't particularly going to go, in the bedroom. I mean, there is stuff in the letters about implicitly. I mean, they're talking in code to each other in the letters, but it's clear that they slept together before marriage, and they talk very frankly, as doctors, of course, about all sorts of things, including her period and so on. So I thought that was fine. I didn't see any problem with that. I didn't want to censor their discussion of her period. That seemed actually indicative of this intimacy they had, and to do with being doctors too. But I didn't want to go crying in the bedroom. They shut the door, they didn't talk about that shit, so I didn't go there. But otherwise, I felt guilty reading the letters, but I didn't feel guilty trying to explore my mother and recover my mother from that. So
Would
Yes, I mean, one thing that I did do after my father, a couple of years after my father died, and my mother had an accident, she had osteoporosis and broke bones very easily, and she was in hospital, and I remember I sat down next to her and tried to make her tell me about that family of hers and her childhood, because, she'd never really talked about it, and she's very reluctant. Not because, not in a... I'm not telling you, but more, it's so boring. Why would anybody be interested, it's that kind of thing. And that's where, I slightly fudged it at the beginning when I said 6-8, because she did get as far as 10. She got as far as naming the 10 children, and she talked very openly about her mother and father. And I thought, there, I've got it, Don't know very much about it, but I've got the bare facts there at least. So I did feel that need to capture this before she was gone, because once my father died, I had a sense of all this slipping away, and so many people have said to me, I only wish I'd asked my mother this, my father that. I left it too late. I really would have liked to know about that. I never bothered to ask. And I realised that the time was short for me too.
How did she feel about having a writer in the family?
Ambivalent, I suppose. She felt ambivalent about the book. I showed her the manuscript, and she didn't object very much at all. And I took out things that she did object to, which included her being Catholic, a reference to her being Catholic. That was the thing that bothered her most. She didn't want that thing. She hadn't told friends. It was clear by the end. The vicar and her at her funeral service alluded to her being a Catholic. It was not such a secret as she thought. I've lost now. What did you ask?
About having a writer in the family.
And she told my sister, she pre-publication, that book was making, the idea of the book was making it suicidal and so on. And then it came out and people liked it, friends said it was all right, and she seemed okay with it. But I don't know. I mean, the truth, I don't know. She said different things at different times about having a writer in the family. Philip Roth famously says, when there's a writer in the family, that family is finished. that family is dead. I want to invert Roth and say, when there's a writer in the family, that family has an afterlife. That family has a second life. A literary life, or a book life, or whatever you want to call it, There was a question at the back there.
Yeah, right at the back.
I want to know why Agnes called you to it.
No, it was, I'm afraid it was my father again, because his mother was, her maiden name was Blake Moore. So Blake came from Blake Moore. It was a way of keeping alive his mother's name. They didn't read poetry.
She's hungry.
That's because your mother loved her better, right? So she's got that, you've got the story.
Yeah, I got that.
You divide up the family.
Not particularly. In the case of the book about my father, most of the stories in it were ones we told each other. You know, well-rehearsed family stories. Remember that time when he jumped the queue in the Dalton Park or whatever. the book about my mother, of course, is, to her as it was to me, mostly unknown territory. She didn't know all this stuff. And so she wouldn't have a different version of it because it predated her as it predated me. Yes. No, that's a good question. I think the truth is she didn't volunteer much then. And you know, I can remember things that were said by both of them, and it's true I might have repressed it all, I suppose, you know, forgotten it all. But I don't think she was particularly willing to talk then. And I've met people who said that after the partner dies, sometimes the other person might have been a bit quiet, but they open up. They're more willing to unburden themselves, and that didn't happen because at the time I sat down next to her, and you said, "Was I young or old?" I was old. she was still, as I say, not reluctant in the sense of, "This is a terrible secret. I'm not telling you over my dead body." But oh God, do we have to bother? The world she left behind—that was the kind of the attitude. So. No, I mean, timing may have been wrong, I don't know, but tactics may have been wrong too, but no, I think she just didn't particularly want to go into this. Not the sole motivation. That's the sort of the natural justice thing, and that was a motive. I think the book about my father's, the motive for that was partly pure therapy, you know, that was therapeutic. I didn't have that same feeling about this. This was, I had much longer to get used to the idea of my mother dying. I wanted to find her, because I felt I'd lost her around the time of her death. I mean, not just lost as you lose someone when they die, but lost in the sense that she'd become more mysterious to me, more enigmatic. Things that happened around the time of her death that were bewildering. So it was an exploration, it was a search for her. It was also, as with the book about my father, an attempt to bring her back to life, I suppose. I wasn't very conscious of that, but I mean, both books, I guess, do that. find the youth in your parents and the life in them when they're dead. wanted to know her better, and perhaps a degree of self-exploration is tied up with that, or self-placing is tied up with that. I'm just to tell the story because I thought it was an interesting story. Yes. Yes, those are the gaps, the times are together, and you can only fill those gaps through their retrospective descriptions of what they did, because they'd say, it was nice seeing you the other day, and when you did. So you had something to go on, but you have to imagine it a bit. And yes, because I think I saw my parents being affectionate with each other, but I didn't see them in love. And maybe that's true with a lot of children. By the time the children come along, that deep in love thing is gone, and you just don't see the overt expression of love and affection that predated you, that made you possible. And there were these love letters. So I could see them in love. And it was a kind of love letter to my mother too, from me, as well as the one that my father wrote. Not with huge deliberation, but I realised that what I'd done was that I had told the story of them in 1940, from 1942 to 45 or 46, using the present tense. That was because that was somehow what the letters conveyed, and caught up in their present tense. I'd use the past tense about the present, about me finding the letters, telling that story, mother died, funeral was left to me. And that this was a separate thing, and it was, yes, the future tense would be the right way, as if to ward it off too, of course, as if you could keep that day back, and the day's already gone, she's dead, but can you get back to that moment before she died, when it still hadn't happened? So the future tense is just seemed the right one to use for that reason. Oh, I think everybody does. I think the very phrase, one day you get the call, one night you get the call, that's always in people's heads about somebody they're close to, whoever it is, but you imagine getting the bad news in some way, and so yes, perhaps it was rehearsed, so it describes more or less what did happen. I've rehearsed the various ways it might happen. No, I mean that was denied to me. No family holidays in Ireland. Irish relations only in our house on our terms. My mother's surname or maiden name is gone, O'Shea. No, didn't feel Irish. Felt as if I was being made to be very English. Maybe Margaret in the audience would confirm this. I mean, I think, in fact, the O'Sheas are pretty, you can get very romantic about being Irish, and imagine they're all poets and artists. I mean, mostly they're kind of bankers and businessmen. It isn't a very romantic island, that's dead and gone, but I feel more sense of it now, and it was denied to me as a child. No. I probably should, shouldn't I? You see, I mean, I think that it's the other thing about this phenomenon, or even genre, you might call it, that it is something to do with the way we live now. I did a reading with Roddy Doyle last week or 2 weeks ago. Now, he's just written a book about his parents, or rather with his parents, because they're still alive. And this book came out of him tape recording them, and it alternates, you know, it's first as his mother's voice, then his father's, and he just is like the editor, as I am sometimes in places here, doing footnotes and very occasionally a sentence to link or give a context. But he's decided, you know, he wants to tell this story now while to get them to tell it while they're still alive. And I've met many people who tell me they're videoing their mother or their father and getting them to talk to or into a tape recorder or a video camera. I think there is this need, which, you know, we as children, I'll speak for myself, Carol may have been totally different, but God, we were so bored by those stories. because, you know, in those days you had the Sunday meal and no television was allowed, and you know, you told each other those stories again. And that's probably gone a bit. That you now, you could, this Roddy Doyle was more or less implying this, that you grow up and not know your parents' stories very well. So you turn around at a certain point and ask them, put it down, get it down. So, yeah, I haven't been very good at telling my children stories about me, but they're not so interesting those stories as my parents ones.
There's a remarkable section in the book Blake wrote about James Bulger and that trial, where you're thinking about all of the ways parents try to ward off evil at the same time that we're constantly anticipating, and you're starting actually with the birth of your baby and going all the way, right the way through this child with all of the potential disasters and how to stop those disasters and so on. And I was just wondering whether part of the writing is a kind of totem against disaster, of holding up the book as a kind of warding off of the chaos and the end of all kinds of remembering. Is that a way of thinking about these books too? Because
yeah,
I was
possibly.
Along with that, there's as you were going through that trauma of listening to the trial, there's a weekend that you go home, and part of you experiencing what you have done up in Preston feels a need to be very close to the children, and the children are otherwise engaged. And on the one hand, the fact that they're sitting there, I think they're watching daytime television on a Sunday morning or something or other, and you're wandering through needing to be with these children. And there's a kind of wonderful resistance to the needs that parents have that is their own kind of, I don't know, insistence on writing their own story that keeps the adults at bay. Maybe when they need to know, they'll come and find out. And maybe.
I mean, that bit you mentioned in As If is, of course, around the time of the Bulger murder. I mean, lots of parents talked about, you know, fear of losing children, and it's just added another way in which a child might be lost, abducted, killed, not just by an adult, or a stranger, but by children. And I go through the fantasies, the common fantasies, or just my fantasies about the way a parent can imagine the death of a child. The other thing is, you know, you would think this passage, which goes on for about 2.5 pages, of different ways in which children can die, or a parent can imagine this child, would be something. I started reading it once in Lancaster, and suddenly people began to laugh. Parents, of course, in the audience. And you know, and by the end they were all hysterical laughter, and I was too, actually, because we were, not because of the, of course, the, well, it's because of the absurdity of the deaths being imagined, but the absurdity too of those parental paranoia.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are well-founded fears and there are absurd fantasies. So maybe that was a kind of warding off. Yes, I will protect my children by imagining the worst thing, and that will somehow keep the worst thing at bay.
There's always somebody who wants to ask a question who hasn't got the courage to. Oh, up there. Yes, go.
Sorry.
I'm not sure about in this book, but I can remember in the in the book about my father, it's a small thing really, but I remember in describing the day of I went to register his death, I described witnessing this row in a tea shop between a young couple, and in fact the row in the tea shop between the young couple, it's just a very vivid scene, happened at another time, not on that day. So I thought it was somehow tied up with my feelings about my father's death and family and so on, but really it didn't literally happen that day, so I cheated. With this book, it's the imagining and the inventing came in the bits where there were the gaps, and I mean there are two bits. There's one about my mother going for a drive with her father in County Kerry, him going about his work, and I heard accounts of, you know, how he went about his work, driving in the car and so on. But that's kind of invented. There are one or two hints that they might have gone on this drive in the letters, but that's about it. And the other one is my father's VD lecture. He described to my mother in the Azores how he was roped into giving a talk to the lads about VD, because there had been quite an incidence of venereal disease in the Azores. And there was one little house in the town which the lads were visiting on a regular basis. And he described in a letter how he'd given this lecture and laid it on thick, and one young pilot had run green-faced from the room. Well, that was enough, really, for me, because remembering my father and how he talked about such matters as gonorrhea and syphilis. I mean, as a doctor maybe, but also as a parent who didn't want his children to have sex lives. If you like, I could just imagine that lecture, and so I let myself go a bit with that, with the VD lecture. But that too, I suppose, is fiction.
There was another question down here, I thought.
Well, that one, of course, I can't answer at all. I can only say I hope they do, and I hope that, you know, you could write a work of family literature that was non-fiction, that could be as compelling as fiction. But, you know, in the end, I suppose, fiction is a harder thing to do. It's more of a challenge. But, I mean, ultimately, you know, I would prefer to write great novels than great work of non-fiction. I don't know. I think as I say, I've read some very good family literature, non-fiction, whether Philip Roth's Patrimony or J.R. Ackerley, just dealing with fathers and sons. I mean, there have been some very compelling non-fictional books. About the genre or subgenre, I don't feel. No, I'm not very conscious of. I don't think. Oh, I'm working in this tradition, and here are all my mates, and I'm. This is the way we do it at all. I think it's a slightly, to be honest, now, in my sector, it's a slightly discredited genre because there's been so much of it in the last 10 years. And I've heard publishers say, you know, the memoir's had it now, the memoir's had its moment, and it's back to fiction. and that would be natural enough. I mean, there was so much that once upon a time, say, in the 1980s, a young writer goes along to a publisher with a book that's sort of based on his or her childhood, and the publisher would say, well, it's good that, you know, you don't transcend your personal circumstances anymore, give it a bit more lift, fictionalise it a bit more. I think in the 90s it was exactly the opposite. What's this? I mean, it'd be really good if you could do this in the first person about your own childhood. Don't bother with the fictionalising. People wanted those professional first person, as it was, kind of stories. But I think that moment has passed. So publishers tell me, I hear that's the same in New York too. So that's why I say I think the genre, which of course the confessional genre or memoir will always be there, but it did have a certain presence and power for a few years, which may now have passed that moment.
My friends will probably immediately tell me that I'm wrong, but my sense about that subgenre was that it was very much a male voice that was speaking out of it. I wonder if you could tell me what that says about masculinity at the present time. Discuss.
Well, I don't know whether I'm one of the friends who'll disagree with you, but I mean, you know, there was Linda Grant and there was Carolyn Stevenson here. This book was certainly about her mother. It's a big book in the
States.
Lorna Sage. Sorry?
Mary Carr.
And see, everybody in the room has got one for you.
Nothing like sticking your neck out, huh?
So, no, you disproved on that one.
Over here.
No, she did visit. She would go back for funerals, weddings, that sort of thing. Just a few days here and there with the sisters who she was closer to. But we weren't invited along, really. She preferred to do that on her own. And in the letters, it's clear she doesn't much relish the idea of my father coming to her hometown and meeting her family. I think, you know, she wanted that for herself. And what applied to him applied to us too. I felt a very strong presence of her over my shoulder, not allowing me to get away with anything that was, you know, not her. I mean, I did have a very vivid sense of whatever the bewilderment I felt after her death, these other things suddenly. I did have a very strong sense of her voice and her presence and her mood. You know, one of the challenges of the book was to write about somebody who was quieter than my father, who was a creature of moods, really, rather than somebody who had adventures, an introvert rather than extrovert. It's always easier. I mean, you know, the larger than life character is in a way always easier for a writer or novelist than a more introverted one. That was quite interesting to have to deal with that challenge. But no, I had a very strong sense, because it is non-fiction in the main, and I have my mother was was a truth. It seems odd, doesn't it, when I've talked to Lena about her withholding things, but in her own terms, she was a very honest person who believed in telling the truth, even if she kept some things to herself. So I did feel her presence over my shoulder saying, well, you couldn't say that about me, that wouldn't be true. You know, that's just for effect, you say that for effect, not allowed. And I tried to honour that. voice in my ear.
So those were some of the things that your mother did tell you then?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.